You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
All right, I think that we will get started. It's my pleasure to welcome you all here today. My name is Elizabeth Jacobs. I am a scholar in governance studies. And I am pleased to welcome you all here today for our event on the skills gap and the role of workforce development policy in tackling that issue. I want to welcome also our web audience. This event is being webcast live, so we have all of you who are here with us in the room today, as well as a virtual audience. So welcome to all of you out there looking at us from your mobile devices and your laptops. We're encouraging everyone to live tweet the event, whether you're here or whether you are out there in the world. And the hashtags are up on the screens. It's hashtag SkillsGap. I'm delighted to have a star-studded panel here today to discuss the intersection of the skills gap and federal job training policy. I'm going to introduce all of our panelists, but I wanted to just take a minute to give a little bit of background about how I came to workforce development policy and job training. So it's not actually where my background started. I was a staffer on the Hill. I was a Senate staffer. My portfolio focused broadly on family economic security and labor market issues. The economy was in the throes of the Great Recession, and then in the early stages of the recovery, we had record high rates of joblessness. I was and I remain particularly concerned with long-term unemployment, which we know has all kinds of deeply negative impacts on not only workers' economic prospects, but also lasting impacts on families and communities. At the same time, we have a remarkably weak policy architecture for workforce development and job training in this country. The main federal policy vehicle, the Workforce Investment Act, which was created in 1998, sort of the latest iteration of the way we do federal job training policy, hasn't been reauthorized since 1998. Obviously, the economy looked very different in 1998. The kind of issues the economy was facing were quite different. The policy remains basically untouched. So we've had decades of inequality. We've had a strikingly polarized economic prospects. They've long suggested, I think, that we need a new way of thinking about how we as a nation invest in human capital. It struck me when I was a Hill staffer back, this is now 5 or 6 years ago, that this was a real window of opportunity for doing something about job training policy, but no one was talking about it. I was not in a position to, you know, poke legislators to get them to talk about it. I mean, I could talk to my bosses, but there's only so much you can do as a staffer. And it really surprised me. So when I kind of retreated back into the world of policy advising in academia. When I came to Brookings, it was one of the questions kind of at the top of my list. It was a real puzzle to me. Why was the reform to the way America does job training not part of the broader conversation? And more broadly, what should a new set of principles for doing human capital investment look like? So I hope you've all picked up the paper that's out there in front. That's kind of one of the fruits of my labors. But really, I'm thrilled to have the opportunity here at Brookings to put together panels like this one where I get to kind of bring, both for my own edification, but obviously more importantly for all of you and hopefully for others out there as well, to really bring people who've been thinking about this issue for quite some time together to generate a conversation and think about how the way we do human capital investment should work, what we can do to actually sort of solve the problem of the skills gap, what policy could be doing better. So that's my more long-winded than usual introduction as to kind of how I came to things, but I thought it would be a somewhat useful frame for putting this all in context. And I will, without further ado, introduce our panelists. I'm going to try and go in order. Laura Chenvin, right next to me, is the director of the Healthcare Career Advancement Program, HCAP, a national organization of major healthcare employers and SEIU unions supporting incumbent worker career advancement and worker development in hospitals, clinics, home care settings, and nursing homes. As director of HCAP, her current focus is on the curriculum development projects that support the transitions of workers to new jobs and new roles in the rapidly changing healthcare environment. She has extensive experience in the field of adult education and workforce development with labor management partnerships. Previously, she worked for the AFL-CIO Working for America Institute, supporting effective partnerships between local Workforce Investment Board representatives and the Workforce Investment Act system. She's also an expert in adult literacy with a focus on vocational English language instruction. Next to her, we have Lance Laverne, who is the director of talent acquisition for Alcoa, Inc., where he leads all of the talent acquisition activity for the company. The scope of activity includes campus, mid-career, and executive recruitment. Prior to joining Alcoa, Laverne was the vice president and chief diversity officer for New York Life. He served as the global head of diversity recruiting for Goldman Sachs, in addition to serving in recruiting roles at McKinsey, Arthur Andersen, and Russell Reynolds and Associates. Next to Lance, we have Vaughn Tonquin-Lavin. Did I get the pronunciation right? Yeah. She is the vice chancellor of workforce and economic development for California's Community College, a position for which she was named a White House champion of change. The Workforce and Economic Development Division administers state and federal funding applied to the career education mission across the system's 112 community colleges. Appointed by Governor Jerry Brown in 2011, Tonquin-Lavin's focus is on doing what matters for jobs and the economy. She's got a website to show you what that's all about. It's the address is in her bio. Prior to her work with the community college system in California, she was the director of workforce development for Pacific Gas and Electric, where she created Power Pathway, a nationally recognized best practice model program in workforce development that exemplifies the type of collaboration between industry, the public workforce system, education, and organized labor that effectively transitions military veterans and members of underserved communities into energy sector jobs. And last but certainly not least, we have Tony Carnevale, who currently serves as research professor and director of the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce, a position he's held since the center was created in 2008. He has a wealth of experience working at the intersection of employment and education policy. He's received appointments in multiple presidential administrations, including his appointment by President Bill Clinton to the National Commission on Employment Policy in 1993, and his subsequent employment by President George W. Bush to the White House Commission on Technology and Adult Education. So, without further ado, I will get started with questions. My plan for our time together is to kick things off and give each of our panelists a question to kind of start working with, and then we'll have some time to have some discussion between the panelists, and then leave plenty of time at the end for questions from the audience. So, get your pens ready. You will have a chance to participate for sure. So I'll start with Laura. You come with a deep background in the healthcare industry, which we know is a large and growing field, especially in light of the aging of the baby boom generation. It seems to me that there's a huge amount of potential here, but also some real stumbling blocks in terms of dead-end jobs that require really hard work but may offer little in terms of economic security or growth potential in terms of career pathways and really building towards a secure economic future for a worker. So what's the path forward for creating the healthcare workforce that we need for the future?
And in 5 minutes, I'm going to tell you exactly what that is. However, the area of weakness that you pointed out, which is a lot of entry-level jobs with a very diverse, both culturally and linguistically, diverse workforce, who are not doing terribly well in today's economy, is actually also our strength. Because that workforce can be the workforce of the future. And so one of the things that our network of union and employer partners around the country is looking at is precisely how do we take this talented, motivated workforce, many of them entry-level jobs, whether it's in home care, environmental service workers, housekeepers in nursing homes and hospitals, or nursing assistants, and create career pathways that can support their aspirations to make a better life for themselves and their families, but also improve the services that the healthcare industry is delivering, because in today's very diverse world, the issue of cultural competency and cultural skills, both linguistically and culturally, is not just a nice thing. It's actually essential to provide the kind of care that we need to serve the population in the United States. So we have a challenge and we have an opportunity. So one of the things that we see are some what you call sort of unintended consequences that come out of policy that doesn't quite fit. We with the cutbacks that we've seen both in the Department of Labor and in the Department of Education, you have a situation where the very people who could be successful moving up a career ladder are held back because of what I would call cherry picking. When you have scarcity of room in colleges, when you have the situation where you'll take those with, let's say, the highest academic skills, those may not be the people you actually need the most. And so we are actually eliminating people through the scarcity of funding. That would be one important issue that we have to address. Another one is what I would call the gatekeeper tests. Gatekeeper tests, we often take standardized tests in order to see whether we're ready to go into a program. But in many cases, these gatekeeper tests also keep out some of the people who could be successful. We actually have some information about that, some experience and some data. It's the kind of data that really needs to be gathered more. We need money for research to be able to show and predict. Outside of just these tests, which do show something, that there are other factors that have to do with motivation, commitment, et cetera, that we can use to help bring more people into the system, not keep them out. I think that another issue is the nimbleness or lack of that in many of our educational institutions. Industry is much nimbler than education, I believe. And many of our partners, in fact, I would say all of our partners, our unions and employers, things are changing so fast in the healthcare industry. We need education to respond quickly. But the way in which funding is structured, again, tends not to go into these multi-employer sector partnerships, including those such as my own, or the one I work for, which includes labor. But instead goes through colleges who may or may not be as tied in to the industry as the industry needs them to be. So people sometimes come out of programs with certificates and degrees and actually can't get a job in the industry because they don't have the skills that the industry is looking for right now. Maybe they have the skills they needed last year, but not this year. So we need to create that bond to keep people working together. So, and last but not least, is that we tend to look at bringing people in. There's a lot of unemployment and people need jobs. But in order to keep that going, you need to also fund career pathways. People need to come into jobs, and they need the opportunity to move up. That's what gives people hope, gives them motivation, deals with retention in the industry, and also creates room at the bottom for people to come in as people move up into higher-paid jobs. So we'd like to see that be something that, as we address policy, we're talking not just about entry, but career pathway work.
Great, thank you. So my question for Lance is actually somewhat similar. Obviously, healthcare and manufacturing are very different fields, but manufacturing remains an equally important part of the economy. The nature of the standard manufacturing job is changing, however, and so are the skills that it demands. So I wonder, what's the path forward to creating a manufacturing workforce that continues to allow America to be globally competitive?
Sure. We've actually seen a resurgence in manufacturing over the last couple of years, and one of the concerns about whether we're going to be able to sustain that is the ability to find the people to continue to make the gains and progress that we've seen in the manufacturing sector. And it's not dissimilar to what you described in the healthcare sector. It's just a different type of industry. And there are a few factors at play. For manufacturing in particular, one of the challenges that we find is just the perception that exists around opportunities in the manufacturing sector. When I guess I would ask, if when most of you think manufacturing, you probably think of some sort of big plant and an assembly line, and it's really dirty and smokestacks and all that. And that's how it used to be years and years ago. But the advanced manufacturing in particular has evolved so much that you wouldn't even recognize a manufacturing plant these days. I remember the first time, I've been at Alcoa for about a year and a half, and the first time I went to one of our facilities, I was getting a tour of our Cleveland Works, huge facility, and at one point I stopped and said, well, where are all the people? And the guy giving me the tour, he actually laughed. He said, it's not an assembly line anymore, Mr. Laverne. We've evolved beyond that. And that's kind of one of the things that we have to help educate people, that there is a much more sophisticated type of role that is required to work in manufacturing these days. One of the challenges around that, though, is that our educational system isn't developing young people in particular with the skills to go into more advanced manufacturing type of roles. Manufacturing is not cool. It's not sexy. It's not fun. They don't, especially young people in particular, don't think of that as the place they would want to go. there is a statistic that's out there that says that of the parents who are exposed or are aware of opportunities in manufacturing, only 20% of those people would encourage their children to pursue opportunities in manufacturing. And so one of our challenges is that we have to actually get to the influencers, especially when we're talking about sort of those entry-level, shop floor, hourly wage roles in manufacturing. We have to encourage people to think more broadly and more positively about the opportunity set that exists there. And then we have to provide them with the skills to pursue those jobs. I mean, again, if I polled the audience and said, how many of you know kids who are involved in some kind of vocational shop type of use your hands thing in their high schools? I bet very few of you would say, yes, they have that curriculum where I live. I know kids. We just don't teach it in our schools anymore. There's been such an emphasis on the four-year college degree path that we have lost sight of the value, as it were, of, you know, doing things with your hands, of manufacturing, of trade. And so one of the other issues that we need to address is how do we regain some of the sort of almost the cachet of being someone who has a skilled trade as opposed to pursuing a four-year college degree. Because not every job we have requires a four-year college degree. In fact, some of them, the four-year college degrees that people are getting, they have nothing to do with what we're doing in manufacturing. But there is a corollary to that story in that we do need STEM-educated, college-trained people. And so the other challenge is the decline in the number of degrees that are conferred in the STEM disciplines. We are moving to more and more liberal arts degrees, and so we are conferring fewer engineering and science and chemistry and metallurgical degrees in the areas that are really important and germane to manufacturing. So that we have to have resources and programs that encourage students early on to consider those, and once they're in those college programs, to help students stay in them because they are difficult and the attrition rates are high. So from a sort of an advanced education perspective, definitely need to have resources available to help people get into and stay into those programs, and then also then can consider manufacturing as an option for once they complete their courses of study. The final point that I'd make, and then we can sort of address more of these things in Q&A, is that, we talk about sort of the high school, an early education component. We talk about the college-educated component. But there's a whole pool of able workers who are the chronically unemployed, the long-term unemployed, returning military veterans and others who would be great candidates for these opportunities and roles if they had access to the appropriate training and skills building to allow them to pursue these types of opportunities. And so we think that the community college system in particular, and I'm sure you'll touch on this, is a great vehicle for helping people gain access to the types of schools and schooling and credentialing and training that's required to make them eligible to take advantage of there's a statistic out there that we have 600,000 manufacturing jobs that are going unfilled because we can't find the right people. Well, now if we can get these folks who are interested in working married up with the programs that can prepare them for that, then that's how we can address some of this skills gap issue. So I'll stop there.
Thank you. So Vaughn, you teed it up well. Community colleges are one of the institutional partners in the workforce development system in the U.S. But unlike many of our competitor nations, Germany is the one that comes up the most often. Collaboration between institutional stakeholders in the American system is often an uphill battle. So I'm wondering, based on your experience, both with the community college system in California and also your private sector experience in energy, what's to be gained by effective collaboration between institutional stakeholders? Who should be involved? Why? And what can policy do to help or hinder that kind of collaboration?
So first, I agree that the network of community colleges are a national asset and should be key players at the table when it comes to closing the skills gap. And you talk about a perception problem over in manufacturing. Let me just do a converse, which is the perception problem of community colleges. I think I would venture to say that many of you in the room think of community colleges as, maybe the cheaper way of doing your first 2 years and then transferring, right? So a lot of our public policies are set up with that in mind. We recently released wage data. We've been tracking wage data of students who've been taking career technical education pathways that are going into vocational workforce areas. So the median wage of students 5 years out for our students who took these vocational sequences is $68,000 compared to roughly in the 30s if you stayed did a non-vocational pathways. And this is putting aside everybody who went to the bachelor's. So you're talking about very strong income, meeting strong need in terms of the economy in both manufacturing, health, and many of our growth sectors. And yet, from a public policy viewpoint, the focus hasn't really honed in on what does it take to unleash the power of the career technical education side of our community colleges. One of the things that we've been doing is a long collaboration is asking the question, the conundrum of what's the organizing principle such that education system, one as complex as ours, could actually play point with industry, because industry and companies have different footprints than, for example, community colleges. So in a state of California with 112 colleges, you can imagine how, you know, as an industry, you know, who has a skill gap, who do you play with? Who do you go to begin to solve your training issues? So what we've done is we've actually, in the last 2 years, restructured our network of colleges under a unifying organizing principle called doing what matters for jobs and the economy. And it's a simple concept, which is organizing colleges such that we target investment at sectors that are important to regional economies, So as a result, the community colleges now have simplified the point people who can play point with industry as they begin to organize and want training needs from our system. So it's a first contact system for industry, but also for others who collaborate. Recently, you know, in California, we have 15 regional economies, very complex with different sectors that drive each economy. And each of these, there were regional forums, leading up to the California Economic Summit. And at this event, it was very clear that the community college became the tier of education to be part of the solution in driving, the solutions to jobs and the economy. So through this organizing principle, we were able to make it more transparent for the system to work with itself, but also for other collaborators and industry to come work with us and take advantage of our assets.
Great, thank you. So Tony, you've been researching this intersection between education and employment policy for quite some time now. So I'm wondering where you see the most promising areas for reform, given both where existing legislation stands, and to throw the sort of the governance studies perspective from Brookings, we talk a lot about party polarization, political polarization, and the political climate. So I would add that in as an additional piece to think about. Is it WEA? Are there other more promising policy vehicles? Should we be giving up on WEA entirely? What should we do? Give us the answers.
But my own bias about these things is that policy is really about what's ideal, except in very precious moments, and generally, especially in areas like this, education, training, and employment policy, it's always about what's next, what's not ideal. And I think what's next, at least given my bias, is relatively clear, and that is we need to build an operating system for the education and training system, that is an information-based operating system that I think attaches less to high schools, more to post-secondary education and the labor market. There are fairly obvious ways to do that, and in sort of higgledy-piggledy fashion, it is happening in the states and at the federal level. I suppose, in the end, the basic feedstocks in this system are two. One is the use of wage record data from employers that tell you if somebody got hired and how much money they make, and can track them pretty successfully over time, with major flaws in the data being that the data does run by industry and not by occupation, which is to say sort of misses the mark from the education side, because the relationship between education and the economy is a relationship between curriculums, not colleges or schools, but curriculums and occupations. But in any event, the wage record data allows us to track what happens to people. Over the last decade or so, states and the federal government have put a ton of money in relative terms, $500 million in the stimulus package, for example. But the Bush people put in a fair amount of money themselves, largely when it began in pursuit of trying to figure out what the American high school dropout rate was. So we've fairly well automated transcript data, hooking up transcript data by program, as well as by institution, because programs that have common names perform differently in different institutions. Somebody takes economics at the University of Virginia may well do differently, I assume worse, than somebody who's an economics major at Georgetown. So there is an operating system here that has been coming for some time. The resistance to it is mighty, largely from the providers, as one would expect. The hookup between wage records and transcript data, I think, is the future of this game and should run across the entire system. We don't need to talk about consolidating the 111 education and training programs or the whatever the number is this year, 29, I think they're picked this year, that need to be consolidated. All you need to do is run a common operating system across them. Most of them have an ambition to provide people with work and with wages. Not the only purpose of these programs, but certainly a key purpose in virtually all of them. The resistance to some extent comes from the fact and a reasonable fact, and that is that higher education in America is and should be dedicated to allowing people to develop themselves so that they can live fully in their time, free from economic catastrophe and free from government or industry power, if you want to play this left and right. In the end, though, in the American system, if you can't get a job, it's very unlikely that you'll be able to live fully in your time. If you're living under a bridge, or if you're very lucky and you have upper-middle-class parents, you can live in their basement. But for the most part, the job is necessary in this system. So educators are fumbling their way forward to build some kind of compromise between their broader mission and their independence from the economy and the government, which is also crucial in this society. Education as an institution needs to be able to stand against government and the economy if it desires to. So there is an accommodation coming here. It is one in which I suspect we'll use wage records and transcript data first for transparency in the system on the education side, and then thereafter for, in many cases, where programs state their intent to make people employable and give them wages that will apply gainful employment regulations. That is, we will disallow public funds for programs that don't deliver when they claim they will. So I think that's the system that's coming online. Until we have it, a good deal more needs to be done. But I suspect until we have it, we won't have either the resources to get things done or the information necessary for students, institutions, legislators, and other people who make decisions about their education and labor market careers. And we certainly won't have the money. That is, we're dropping $400 billion on higher education now. I don't know off the top of my head, but it's $600 billion for K-12. Probably 150, 200 of that is high school. This is not about money. We've got $550, $600 billion to play with. These information systems at maximum would cost, in their current state, would cost us tens of millions to bring them online and maintain them. So in the end, the issue gets to be how we repurpose parts of the education system for this purpose. The other system that we experimented with since the 70s in the U.S. Department of Labor is basically now a small social program. We shifted policy fairly dramatically after CETA and public service jobs towards an education solution for good reason, because a lot of the training in the workforce development system didn't deliver either jobs or earnings. More K-12 careful and longer-term programs in education are required. The public supports behind education, not workforce development programs from labor departments. Labor power is much diminished in these times, so that it's not really possible that the labor departments in D.C. or anywhere else will be able to get the muscle to build employment policy programs. There is something lost here, which is if you go to an educator with a problem, the solution is always go to school. Oftentimes, people with labor market problems really don't need training. They need a job. So I think one of the key issues will be how we include this employment policy perspective in an education-driven training system.
So I want to stay on the data point for a moment because I'm trained as a social scientist, so I, too, believe that data can solve all problems. But actually, I don't think that data can solve all problems. I think that that data needs to be put into action to solve problems. And happily, we have three people who I think it's fair to term are practitioners in a variety of different fields where they might put that data to use. So I'm curious to hear from each of you of how Tony's message resonates, first of all, and second of all, how you're using or struggling to use data in order to achieve some of the objectives that we've talked about so far. I'll let whoever wants to jump in first jump in.
Well, we were right with you when it came to data. It took us 2 years and a bill in order to get the wage data so that we can map it to students, and all the privacy is protected, so it's more of you know, you have to have a sample size of 10. So if you have concerns about that, the states have figured out the algorithm to protect individual privacy. So we are definitely there with you with regards to data. I think the other, when you talk about designing the operating system, one of the things that we should rethink from a public policy is this notion, especially as you, from the perspective of education, is the construct of time. Right? And the construct of time is actually holding our post-secondary institutions back from really solving the skills gap. We kind of alluded to it. Both speakers talked about how fast industry is moving and the skill needs have evolved, and yet the construct of time for post-secondary is still the same old construct as 10, 20, 100, you know, 200, you know, since the beginning of time. Think about it. I mean, you had snail mail, and then it became fax, and then it became email, and now you're Twittering and texting, right? So the speed at which business is operating and the life cycle of skills, it's evolving so quickly, yet everything we do as institutions and post-secondary is around this unit of time called the credit hour, right? Which means you will spend quarters and semesters in this time rather than a mastery of content. And the way that students go through has to do with credit hours and how their financial aid packages are structured is around the credit hours. How post-secondary institutions are funded at the by states and by the feds, it's against credit hours. So everything that is set up in terms of public policies reinforces this notion of time that no longer works in terms of the pace that post-secondary needs to move in order to match, kind of run alongside with the needs of industry.
I'm not sure that exactly speaks to data, but I do want to talk about that. I mean, is that the issue in healthcare is that people develop competencies over time, and there is some move within post-secondary education to begin to look at competency-based assessments. That starts to address the issue that you're talking about. It also starts to address the issue from the worker perspective, which is I can't afford in this economy today to not work and go to school full time, sometimes not even half time. But I can, over time, accumulate knowledge, skill, and competency that should, in a rational universe, allow me to advance professionally, wage-wise, etc. But as you said, there is a mismatch. But I do think that we're starting to take a look at that. but I think it's very difficult. And I'm happy to see you address that as really a policy issue, because institutions move so slowly. We need to be able to fund experiments and then document them so that, and then that does eventually come back to data, so that we have the evidence basis in the data that says, you know what, this works better than what we've been used to doing, and maybe now we can change.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've heard in this discourse, especially around, you know, competency-based learning from an educational institution perspective, is the cultural challenges that might exist in making that shift within our institutions of higher learning. I was at a session yesterday where this was a big topic of conversation, and I would certainly, you know, ask, you know, either of you from your perspectives, you know, are there cultural barriers in our educational institutions that, you know, will pose the challenge to creating more of competency-based learning that speaks to the issues that we're talking about here?
Well, I can tell you from my own experience that about a month ago, I was quoted in talking to somebody in a training newsletter saying that I said something about classics. And I immediately heard from the classics department at Georgetown and many of their former students, and in the end I had to apologize, the discretion being the better part of valor. And so then I switched to rhetoric. I said, well, majoring in rhetoric, if people think majoring in rhetoric is going to make them the money that an engineer makes, they need better information. And I discovered that there are rhetoric majors.
There you go.
So I know that cultural clash intimately. Yeah. In the end, I do think there's a way of working it out. I think there's a problem in working it out, and that is African-American, Latino, and working-class kids and poor kids will get the job training. And it's the way it works now. And the white middle-class kids, upper-middle-class kids, will get the more general education, which has value in and of itself and value in the labor market. So, and we see that. We just did a study in which we found that since 1994, 82% of the new enrollments among white kids are at the top 468 colleges, and 72% of the new enrollments since 1994 among African Americans and Latinos and low-income kids were in the open admission two-year schools and bottom-tier four-year institutions. So the American system, while it is providing more and more access to education, as it did in K-12, is immediately differentiating that access by class and race very fast.
Go ahead. If I could sort of raise that question again, looking at what you raised as the two-year to four-year path, mm-hmm. and the voc ed
career tech
pathway, is one of the things we've found, and this is very much true in healthcare, is that there's a need for people to switch between them as you go up the ladder. So coming in to a voc tech environment where you're getting a more vocational skill, if you really want to go further in healthcare, you at some point do need to transfer. But we're finding that, and that's good. That's a good thing, you know. But we're finding that the colleges, again, structurally, very few of them have credits that really transfer between the vocational departments and the academic departments. It's like you have to make a choice when you shouldn't have to make a choice. And so I was just wondering if you're seeing any shifts there, any movement in that direction.
Well, I think the notion that, for example, in the education field, you think, oh, someone becomes an engineer. Wow, they're set for life, right? Now, how ridiculous a notion is that your skills earned at 22 is going to last you for the next 50, 60 years, and that you would not have to be reskilled given how fast the, you know, technological changes are happening, as well as everything else. So I really fundamentally believe that our systems need to be structured in a way that people can come in and out and get stackable credentials. So your circumstances may be such that you get, you know, your one-year certificate right now that gets you into an allied health career, but then your employer may be sending you back to stack more credentials in that, and then 10 years later you may go back and do a BA, an MA, doctorate, or maybe just lateral and do different kinds of careers. I mean, we all know that you're going to have at least 7 careers over the lifetime, so it's not going to be a one time at the trough in terms of the acquiring education. I was on this the American Association of Community Colleges, AACC. We had a task force called Closing the Skills Gap Task Force. And around the table were about 12 of some of the most progressive leaders of community colleges, you know, large urban district, rural districts, big states, small states. And as I listened to what they had to do in order to have our system respond and on the workforce need and to close the skill gap, what occurred to me was that everybody in that room was a hero. And there were like heroic efforts being undertaken by each of these individuals to solve the skill gap. And that's not right. You can't have a system of thousands of colleges trying to tackle this problem through heroic effort. And you have heroic effort only when the money, the metrics, and the data are not well aligned with the problems that you're trying to solve. So I really believe in the data, and then the data tied with the money and metrics. What are you incenting? What are you paying for? What kind of behavior do you want from the students? What kind of behavior do you want from the institutions? They need to match so that we're all rowing in the same direction to solve the skill gap.
So I want to bring it back to policy, and I think this may put each of you on the spot, but hopefully you can take your time, take a deep breath, and I suspect that each of you will be able to relatively quickly come up with an answer to two questions. So I'd like everyone to name at least one way that the federal government gets in the way of effective workforce development strategies, and one way that the federal government is a necessary part of the solution. And I ask for both because I think that there are lots of ways, at least from my point of view, there are obviously lots of ways that the federal government needs to be involved. I wrote a whole paper on it. But I also think that there are ways that the federal government shouldn't be involved. Some of those may be things that we've done away with already, but I'm curious for each of you, given that you engage in kind of the nitty-gritty on a more daily basis, and Tony, you think a lot about both the policy and the research that's out there. I'm curious what your perspective is, and we'll see if we come up with any points of consensus or whether I just generate a big fight on stage, which is always my goal. So whoever wants to jump in, I'll just go down the line.
I'll jump in first because
great.
Certainly what we talked about this prior to coming out here and again in this discussion I was in yesterday, one of the issues is around funding of programs. And a specific example that was brought up was the Pell Grant funding and how it is used, where you can use it in your education. And I believe Pell Grant funding is not applicable to certification type programs. But if we're trying to give people skills to get them back to work, to me it would seem a really good thing to do to change the nature of how Pell Grant funding can be applied. And so if you want to get people back to work, allow them to use this support mechanism to get them the skills they need to get the jobs that are available. So that's why I wanted to go first, because that's an easy one.
So is that supposed to help and hurt? It's hurting because it's hurting, we can't do it now, but
if they change it, it would help. There you go.
Two birds, one stone. That was efficient.
All right, I'll go. I think we should look at the reward structure, right? So when we talked about the money and the metrics and the data. So reward students, if what we want is students to complete certificates, degrees, and industry-recognized credentials, and report the data back that they did this, that they reached these milestones, how do we structure financial aid in a way consistent with the behavior that we want? And then also the converse is to reward institutions as they're designing the courses, the programs, and the pathways that perform. How do they do in the employment, the wage gain, as well as the completion of these certificates, degrees, and third-party credentials? In terms of in the way, well, it's not really, it's something to consider. On the WIA side, the Workforce Investment Act side, especially in communities, underserved communities that are struggling with the sort of the competing in this economy, I think we need to rethink about how what metrics we have, and everything that we're oriented is towards the individual, yet it takes, perhaps we should consider what's the highest level of attainment of education or highest level of attainment on wage for the household, because it is a household, and if you think about a skill acquisition over time, on the WIA side, it may be the investment in the household that may get us out of these circumstances much faster than if we were just only thinking about the individual and targeting intervention at the individual.
I mean, you know, there's so much to say, and I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I don't disagree with anything anybody's said so far. I just think there's so much more that could be done, and part of it is that our funding is very limited, that the value, I'm sorry to say, that we are placing on our education structure and on job creation, job development, is just terrible. And so we can talk about how to divvy up a really pretty small pot in better ways, and I think there's lots of ways we can do better. But there's just not enough to go around in such a critical area. So the government could do a lot more. It doesn't have the money to do that. I think that speaks to the political environment that we're in. I think we have a real crisis in the issue of career development and supporting disadvantaged communities moving forward. I think all of us, I think your point to heroic efforts, I think all of us are doing everything we can with absolutely insufficient resources to move things along. In the healthcare industry, many of our employers are investing millions and millions of dollars to support the workforce going forward. They need to be also spending that money on healthcare, and yet they're having to spend so much money on training because we're not working together because we don't have a really rational system where, in fact, one of the things that we've often talked about is if the industry is actually providing some of the education, why isn't the industry getting some of the funding for workforce? So, I mean, that's a whole other area. So I could talk for a few hours on this, but enough. So.
I guess my take on this is that in the end, what's too bad about this, where the federal government fails most, is that it doesn't have a jobs policy. In truth, in the end, this is the jobs policy, and it's a very weak in slender reed, because education and training doesn't create jobs except for people who are employed in education and training. In the end, if you don't have a demand in the economy for magicians, you don't get much magic. So I think in the final analysis, the great failure here is on the employment policy side, and there's a vacuum there in my judgment. That's a lot of people disagree with that, but I that's what I think. And then I think if we could stimulate demand, all this would work a lot better. But secondly, I do think the good thing is with the money short, although the path of least resistance is to allow in the federal government and the state as well, is to allow the money to flow to health care and to pensions in the case of the Fed and the case of the states too. So one of the ways this gets handled is you gradually let education and training die on the vine. That's the path of least resistance. Confronting these issues, these more difficult questions we're all talking about, is difficult, and there is no center to deal between right and left on these questions. So, but I do think the one thing that they are doing is that the gainful employment regulations are the point of the spear in this effort, and that the not-for-profit colleges are kind of like the illegitimate redheaded stepchild at the family reunion. I mean, nobody likes them, so you can do whatever you want to them, and we are, and we're after them. And in the end, it is a gainful employment agenda that I think underlies most of the momentum in this arena that is attaching post-secondary, for the most part, although I would argue secondary too, to labor markets is the answer, and gainful employment is the sharpest thing we're doing in that arena.
Great.
So I think I will open it up to audience questions now. You should see people floating around with a floating microphone. It's also for folks who are out there watching the webcast. You are welcome to tweet in your questions, and we have folks who will be collecting those virtual questions. So I'll start right here in front. If you could say your name, if you have an organizational affiliation that you'd like to share, you're welcome to share that. And please make your question a question, not a statement.
My name is Judd Heary, and I'm a documentary filmmaker. My question is for Mr. Laverne. With respect to the interface between industry and post-secondary institutions like community colleges, are the needs, are the skill gaps and the needs within your sector general enough so that you could go to a secondary school and say, this is what we need for a certificate program? For example, computerized production control systems. I mean, my question is, are your needs general enough so that you could go to a community college and help design a certificate program to meet those needs?
Interestingly enough, I would turn around and say our needs are pretty clearly defined enough, almost specific enough, for us to be able to do that. And that, in fact, is happening in the manufacturing sector. The Manufacturing Institute and the National Association of Manufacturers have worked very diligently to create certifications that do exist, and there is a lot of partnership that is happening with community colleges and manufacturers to design that curriculum, to develop and deliver those curricula, and then to create opportunities for on-the-job training as well to meet this demand. I mean, those are examples. You know, we work with at Alcoa in particular with community colleges in Southern California, in South Carolina, in Ohio, to do this very specific thing. We have, you know, employees of Alcoa who have worked with folks at these community colleges and helped design courses and training that specifically speak to the needs that we have at our facilities. Our employees go and actually participate in the delivery of that training, and then we create internship and apprenticeship opportunities so that people can get the on-the-job training to complete the entire learning process. And so that's an example of a partnership, and we're not the only ones who do that. There are plenty of manufacturers that are doing this as well, but that's how it gets done. And there, and we have been able to, you know, as an industry, define very specifically what it is that our industry needs at a variety of different levels within manufacturing so that we can create those certifications and then educate people as to what they need to do to get them.
And be dynamic enough so the teacher needs next year.
Right. It is. Yes, your point about being dynamic, it is not a static process, and it definitely needs to be refreshed periodically to keep pace with the change that we're experiencing in our industry.
Pink sweater.
Hello, my name is Cindy Walsh, and I'm an academic. First of all, I'd like to give a perspective of what education is in America to most people. The founding fathers developed our education system to make the American citizens citizens. And that's why education has always been broad, so that the American people would be ready to play the part of being a politician, a citizen, a leader. And that's why we still want that to happen. That is the goal of American education. When you, at the same time, we had unions with wonderful apprenticeships. And it was that partnership between business and union apprenticeships, human resources departments within the businesses, that created the specialties in the job. So that when people graduated with history degrees or English degrees, the only thing that was required of them was to be ready to be middle management, the people who oversaw regulations, workplace safety, quality control. That's how it all worked, and it worked wonderfully. For over a century, we were the most productive country in the world. My concern, and this is my question, okay, if we allow this system to break down to where a community college becomes a human resources department and taxpayers pay for each time, as the lady here said, people will change careers 5, 6, 7 times. And each time they'll go back to the community college for the taxpayer to pay for that retraining. It doesn't seem very efficient, and it seems like it might get pretty expensive and cut into the ability to fund higher level education, like secondary 4-year colleges. Is that a concern for you guys?
No.
This is not a time when it's a one-size-fits-all economy anymore. I think there's different pathways for different people. The concern, I think, the shared concern from a public policy is more one of, we've had multiple incidences in our country where the supply for skilled worker did not meet the demand for skilled worker. We fell short. So the shortage of engineers, for example, we ended up as a country going to other countries to import the engineering talent, especially in Silicon Valley. Now, you look at the nursing shortage that occurred, that was not too long ago. When I had my first child, the lady who took care, the nurse who took care for me, of me was actually from Malaysia, because we did not supply enough skilled nurses to actually take care of our own citizens. So I don't think we're engaging in the broadest of philosophical debate. I think we're talking about how to actually get the supply and demand of skilled worker to match what is needed by the economy, how to get our communities most competitive for the jobs and the skill requirements of those jobs in the future. Because as we know, at the end of the day, companies will solve their talent problem. And they will go, they'll have some patience, but they will go and find that talent. And it may not necessarily be in our backyard, in any of our states, on American soil, and it may be abroad. And at that point in time, we have lost that job. So from an institutional point of view, what I want is I want our communities to be most competitive for those future careers and to position our communities with the right skills. And that's the importance that I see community colleges and our public institutions playing in the skills gap question.
Thank you for that frame. I think that's really a very, very good one. But I also think in terms of your concern about a liberal education and a broad education, that is something that we need more people to have access to, way more than had access 100 years ago or even 200 years ago, where those kinds of college educations were really for the elite for the most part. What we've done is City University in New York used to be completely free, no longer. And we also have, and one of the things I love about working in the healthcare field is that you can come in at a vocational level and end up with a doctorate. That the emphasis on building critical thinking skills and a real sort of metacognitive understanding of science and culture and all of these things that go into making the kind of citizen that you're talking about is part of it. What the community college system does is open that access up to a much broader group of people that have been able to do that in the past. Not all of them will pursue that, but if we structure these college opportunities the way we've been talking about it today, with the transfer between vocational and academic education, between vocational, professional, and advanced degree education, we will build the kind of society that I think it will be both economically viable but also serve the interests, as you speak, of sort of the democratic aspirations of our country, which involve critical thinking and education for our population.
I guess I would say you frame the question exactly. That is the context of this debate, such as it is. But one of my problems with the debate is that it isn't one, really, and that is that what we've got are people squared off into different positions, most of which frees us in the present, looking in the rearview mirror at some vague past that, frankly, I can't see it when people talk about it. I don't remember it, and I've been around for a while. So the in the end, I think the future's in front of us. This question is up. And if anything distinguishes us as Americans, it's our ability to get things done, not to get bogged down in ideological debates and wafty issues. I mean, my European friend in Europe always said to me that you Americans are superficial and materialistic, but by God, you get things done. But we don't get things done anymore, and it's precisely because we've squared off. And this is an issue that's up. And I guess what I would offer is that in the end, for me, my own values, if I had to choose for someone between a job and an education, I'd get them the job. Because I don't think you're a person in America unless you can get a job.
Elise Schanbecker, NGA. I actually wanted to return to the industry-recognized credential point that you made. And, you know, it sounds, when I hear people talk about industry-recognized credentials, on the one hand, you hear these success stories. It sounds like Alcoa has a system that's working well, but it seems to be in pockets, because on the other hand, you know, I hear from workforce development folks and even community colleges, they would be actually very happy to get people the skills they need to get a job, but they don't know what the industry-recognized credential is. There isn't a searchable database. There isn't validation. So my question is, what do you see as then the next step for scaling the system of industry-recognized credentials, and is it going to be sort of pocket by pocket from the ground up, think global, act local, or is there something you can do at a higher level to scale up the use of industry-recognized credentials?
I'll start, but you certainly can chime in. You know, right now, I think, you know, most of these efforts, if not all of these efforts, are being led by industry associations. And so that's why you don't have a, you know, more collective access to broad information. You know, what I spoke of really isn't an Alcoa thing. It's really a manufacturing industry effort that's underway. And there are other industry associations that are moving in that same direction. You know, one of the things that is part of the conversation is, how do you bring those different disparate groups together collectively? And what organization, entity, body can do that? Because individually, the 20, 25 or so industry associations that you might see out there, they're not going to, on their own, come together to do this. And that might be one of the policy issues that we should think about addressing. Is that a role that the federal government can play in sort of creating sort of the baseline or even the access to the information about these types of credentials and what it takes and to achieve them, and where people can go to get the information or the skills or the training to pursue them? Because it doesn't exist now, and it's that access to the information that is a real big question in this whole discussion. Nobody else?
Okay. I'm going to go to the back of the room. I saw some hands back there. Glasses all the way in the back.
I'm Ariane Hikovic from the Institute for Women's Policy Research. My question is about career and technical education, which probably, well, is much more gender segregated than four-year college fields. And we know that there are examples, for example, from California, where community colleges reach out specifically to design courses to bring women into technical or trade careers, which work because you get a cohort and retention works, but they're very minimal and they're very few, and we kind of seem to have stopped paying attention to greater gender integration in those fields since the late 90s. So I have two questions. One, does this still matter? Is it still an issue? Women can progress in healthcare. Do we mind that it is so segregated and there are very few women in manufacturing? And the second issue is this slightly related? You've talked about giving information to people. Increasingly, people who need to access skills and learning are adults already. 40% of people in the workforce who haven't progressed beyond high school diplomas. So are the arguments that you made the same for adults as they would be for students, and how does gender fit into getting people to pursue non-traditional careers? Thanks.
Just one data point about that. I'm not sure it's true that applied community college certificates and degrees are any more gender segregated than four-year college degrees. About when you look across the certificates and two-year degrees, especially the occupation-specific ones, a lot of them are 80-85% male, and they're all the ones with the high earnings return. So in a lot of those, you make more money than 30-40% of college graduates, substantially more. And the college graduates you make more money than are almost always women. So, and then when you go into the four-year schools, it looks very similar. That is, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics is 75-80% male, if not more. Business is a little more diverse, but not a lot. Women in business, if you look at the different majors, economics, business economics, accounting, finance, management, marketing, women are highly concentrated in hospitality, which is the lowest paid business major. So even though women have made great progress in moving through higher levels of education attainment, their gender segregation is, I think it's, at least when I look at it, it stuns me. I think it's extreme in both four-year college, less so, everything is less so in graduate school. But four-year school still and two-year school still.
You know, certainly, you know, from an engineering perspective, you know, I would somewhere in the order of 65-70% of the people that we hire at Alcoa, and I'm sure it's similar at other manufacturing companies, are engineers, mechanical, metallurgical, industrial, whatever it is. And prior to working at Alcoa, I worked in financial services, and so when we would look at our diversity statistics, you know, our goal was to have 50% of our, you know, campus and entry level hiring be female because that was close to what the representation was at our schools. At Alcoa, you know, if we can get to 25% female representation in our entry-level hiring, we're excited because there just aren't as many women in these disciplines. And so from an industry perspective, you know, we try to do what we can to support organizations that are encouraging women and, more importantly, girls to stay on those STEM tracks. You know, a great example is the Society of Women Engineers, which is really focused on reaching back, you know, into the, you know, the, you know, middle school and high school populations to encourage girls to stay in math, stay in engineering. And I think, you know, corporate partners like Alcoa and others, you know, need to be very active in supporting those efforts. Otherwise, I don't think we're going to make much progress in creating greater gender diversity in STEM disciplines.
Let's go right in front.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman, and I have a question that more or less underlies this. From what I've read, we may be, in the past, as we've developed new labor-saving technologies, other jobs have come along and were roughly equal. But we may be reaching the point where there aren't alternative jobs. So, and maybe with the labor unemployment problem now, we may have reached that problem. Does anybody feel that we may not be, at least with the current structure, be able to keep everybody employed?
That are the robots coming to get us question. The robots are coming, right? They'll take the entry-level jobs. Yes,
I think... Maybe, and I'll look to my colleagues over here, that maybe the issue is that we're not, that there are a lot of jobs out, but they're very low-wage jobs. Mm. There's a tremendous job creation in the service industry, which is very low-wage. And so it's not that there isn't employment. It's whether or not your family can survive. And so we have many examples of people who work two and even three full-time jobs. There's been some documentation, I know, in the Times recently about just sort of talking about what that's like for someone's life. So that's the way I'm seeing it. I don't know what others might think.
We're all kind of looking at Tony here, jobs policy. You think you kind of meant you touched on it?
The temptation on this question always is that this story comes up every time there's a recession, and everybody's sure of it every time. I mean, it started with the physiocrats in the 17th century saying that, you know, Malthus and everybody saying that when people went off the land, we'd all starve to death because we couldn't make enough food. So this story is a recurrent one in human history. It never ends up being true. Most of the current, there are two current versions of it. One of them is the Bill Gates view, which is the robots are coming. But if that's the case, because we've done this, others have done this, we've done this calculation, if you wanted to get to a substantial 15% or so unemployment rate with it, but by 2040, you'd have to have 10% productivity improvements per year between now and then. That seems very unlikely. It's unprecedented in even our history between 46 and 73. If it does come, why are we so worried? That is, we'll be very rich with nothing to do. Then we'll probably have to talk to each other, and that's probably not as much fun as work. But in the or we'll have to redistribute the income in some way that violates our culture. But the other argument is that we're going to have very low growth. That one, to me, has a little more traction, that growth will struggle around 1 or 2%. But there really is no data-based argument for that. There are a set of factors that say that that will happen, but that remains to be seen, I think.
I think it also changes the mix of skills. So, for example, some of our regions that have high dependency on agriculture, a competency for that region, a skill competency, would be the automation or applying robotics to the agricultural field, right? So if you know it's coming, if the technology can be there, from an economic development strategy, how do you actually build human talent in that region to compete for that type of set of activities?
But having said that, let me say one other thing, because I just recalled. In this building in the 1970s, I was part of a group like this, and we were talking about the likely effect of computers on the economy. And Bill Gates had delivered the opening address and then left, thank God. Because after he left, all of us on the panel agreed that he was nuts. And that, what I remember my comment was, what are people going to use all these personal computers for? To make shopping lists? I mean, what's the use of them?
Yes.
So, yeah, so, but they use them for many other things, too. So, the technology argument never seems to come fully round, but there's always a possibility it will. I mean, it seems to me.
Well, and I think your point about technology, are we going to use them for shopping lists? There's sort of, you make a point right there, we do, but that creates demand and a whole new set of jobs. Is it in an industry that we see is growing and creating, you know, upwardly mobile careers for people? That's an open question. But, I mean, new technology doesn't necessarily mean the end. It can mean the beginning of something new. The question is just figuring out how to predict that accurately and be prepared for it in a way that actually works. Other questions? Let's go to the back again.
Hi, my name's Alexandra, and I'm with Hagerstadt. We've talked about closing the gap through community colleges and higher education, but I have a slightly different question. Are there ways to also close the gap by focusing on juvenile offenders and prisoner reentry programs? How do we include those populations in this discussion and, you know, make sure that they're also becoming a part of that pipeline?
Well, you know, it would seem to me that when we talk about some of the programmatic solutions, they can almost be agnostic to population. You know, whether you're talking about juvenile delinquents or, you know, released convicts, or you're talking a different class of person, you're talking about, you know, released military veterans who are coming back, coming off of service, or women who have off-ramped and are trying to get back into the workforce. I mean, there's a huge spectrum of people that could funnel into these types of solutions that we're discussing. And so the real question is there interest in tapping into or accessing or supporting those different pools? And, you know, some are certainly more appealing than others, but if we are looking at a full, you know, full solution, we probably should consider all available sources of talent.
I think we have to think about the intentional design of some of our public systems. So the post-secondary system, what are we good at? We're good at training, right? We're not good at all the wraparound service and finding, you know, childcare and then bus money and all of this case management or mental health issues. We actually need the parallel systems So, for example, the public workforce system, who have better competencies in terms of reaching out to high-need communities and providing the case management and all the wraparound so that they can have that and build skills through our system. So expect one system to do it all, but that's not the core competency of training institutions. You know, we can't do it all. We actually need the intentional design of these systems to be working together so that populations that you're talking about, or I've run several, a lot of all veterans cohorts. You know, there's actually, you know, custom curriculum that you need, and then also case management that you need in order to facilitate successful transition. But it works really well when the two systems work together to target a population.
There's a very good program. It doesn't speak specifically to the incarcerated population or the released population, but it does speak to what you're saying. It's called actually the HEAT program. It's called Health Education Employee Program. I got the name. It's called HEAT. Anyway, by the Washington State Board of Community and Technical Colleges, and it specifically funds a industry education partnership to do exactly what you're talking about. So it has unions and employers and education looking at how do we create capacity to keep students in school, to address barrier issues, and to do it collectively across institutions. It's very difficult because institutions are institutions, and each of them have their own culture. But when it works, we've seen tremendous, and actually it has worked, we've seen tremendous outcomes where students who you would not predict would do well, do fabulously well, and in fact better than, in many cases, than their peers who from all sort of predictors you'd think would do better. So that's a situation which I think can apply to the issue of people coming out of prisons, et cetera. In healthcare, there is an issue in healthcare, which is people do need to pass background checks in ways that in other industries they may not have to. However, I do think that there's a lot of room for thinking broadly on what are the kinds of background checks that are okay in the healthcare industry and what are not. And I don't think there is a sort of a national standard on that question.
I would just chime in on top of that, just in terms of the importance of the prison pipeline, that the unemployment figures that you see every month don't actually include any of the prison population. So, I mean, it's actually a pretty enormous sort of additional problem on top of the more obvious ones that we talk about. The problem in terms of employment issues are broader than you might initially think, because that population just isn't there at all. They're pretty invisible. So there are a bunch of other hands.
Oh, I just see right here. It's the Hospital Employee Education and Training Project. That's the HEAT program from Washington.
Thank you.
My name is Clayton Witt. I'm with one of the local governments, Department of Employment Services. Just like all politics is local, finding a job or jobs are local issues. In an area like Washington, D.C., with a very urban population, they don't have the acreage to put these production centers in place, such as the apprenticeship program at Siemens and the like. But the question is twofold. How do you partner or develop partnerships with these corporations to have substantial or real earnings-generating opportunities in the production, in a production-oriented environment? And the second part of that, in lacking the ability to do that, how do we push the service sector, or how can the service sector be prodded to provide pathways to more meaningful earnings opportunities after the initial openings, especially in the home health field and in the retail and restaurant space?
Well, in the service area, I think there's actually a whole movement really in this country to take a look at, and SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, is really leading on this, to take a look at valuing the contribution of the home health industry in actually cost savings and improved health outcomes. And in looking at that, looking at opportunities to train for higher, for a stepped system within the home health system. Also, there are a number of programs that are looking at career pathways so that if someone enters into that, they then can move into community health workers, community educators, and medical assistants. But these are jobs that are actually just emerging, and there's a lot of conversation. I don't think we've figured this out. I think a lot of colleges are also looking at this stackable credential. How do we make it easier for people who come in at an entry level and really get turned on and want to move ahead to utilize those skills and competencies that they have achieved and move them into something else. But I think you're seeing the beginning of that happening. The Affordable Care Act is putting a lot of pressure on institutions to move health care services out into the community and to understand what are the needed competencies. So it's not really an answer of exactly what's happening, but in the over the next couple of years, I think that pathway is going to be much more developed, primarily by the industry and in partnership with community colleges.
So I think we have time for one last question. You got your hand up really fast right there.
Okay, so this is sort of related to what you were saying about how if industries can't find the talent that they need in this country, they will look overseas and those jobs will go abroad. My question is, if we're frequently going abroad to find the talent that we need, is there some kind of training program or other thing that's being utilized in other countries to close the skills gap and a way that they're doing it more effectively than we are that we could emulate in this country so that we could better close the skills gap? Just trying to do what they're doing overseas so that those jobs come back.
I think it's this is the collective conversation, right? What are our policies? How do we get the money, the metrics, and the data to align so that we can produce the skilled workers that are needed today, right? And so my framework, having been on the employer side, is that there's a universal behavior among everybody who needs to hire, which is, you need to hire the right people with the right skills at the right time, right? And what employers are looking for is really the ready now pool. And they want to hire from the ready now pool. They're willing to make some investment in a near ready pool, right? In some training or some work-based learning or some apprenticeship in order to get them to be ready now. But what's so difficult, I think, is the misexpectations where we have a lot of far-from-ready candidates and expect employers to be able to tap into that pool. So that's where a lot of our public system, so that when we think about the public infrastructure and the intentional design, how do we get more of these populations, our populations, to move, you know, from far-from-ready to near-ready to being ready now? And so, you know, what are all the different methods that we have at play? What systems do we have where we can braid resources together to move our talent pool? The consequence is that I think most companies aren't interested in doing so much work to go recruit, you know, far from its base. But if it has to, you know, if it is asked to wait a long period of time, that's when it must go and find the skills that it needs. Once that happens, then a pattern has developed. Wherever that place is that they recruited from that was successful, they go back. Then the behavior, they just go back to that place. So really, our collective work is to make sure that when business has that need to hire the right person with the right skill at the right time, it is in our backyard, it is in our communities. So that way we can keep the whole economic effect right there, local.
Good answer. I wonder, Lance, if you might give a last word. Maybe this is unfair because I'm going to ask you to channel Clef, but I know Alcoa's CEO has done a lot of work on the skills gap and goes and he's traveled internationally to talk about it. He's German. Germany is one of the kind of great models for how to do this kind of work, and it's often cited as an example of how the U.S. might do better. Are there Alcoa examples from abroad, sort of speaking directly as an industry practitioner with a company that works globally that you could think of? Feel free to take tasks. Obviously, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm wondering whether whether you might have insight.
No, you rightfully note that this is a very important issue to our CEO, and he is really trying to provide some thought leadership and to be very front and center on this issue. He is German, and one particular example of an adoption of a European practice is around this issue of the value of a trade that we just seem to have lost here in the U.S. I was talking with some colleagues on this issue, and both the German and the Swiss have very well-developed apprenticeship programs that people can choose relatively early in their educational tracks. And there is no stigma to saying you want to be a skilled tradesperson. And there is a path and a process to getting the education and the training that you need and a career that you can have that is not a four-year university type of career. And so if we could figure out how to create some of that same appeal that exists for being on a skilled trades path versus a four-year college path, we'd probably see a lot more people choosing that direction, and it would go a long way to closing some of this skills gap that we see.
Thank you. I want to respect all of your time and end on time. I know many of us here would be happy to keep on talking for the rest of the afternoon, but I encourage you to keep on talking amongst yourselves, and thank you so much for coming. A big thank you to all of our panelists. Some of you have traveled a very long way to be here. Thank you.